restaurant, overlooking the sparkling Persian Gulf. A 22-year-old Lo sat down for lunch with Yusuf Aloteba, a fresh-faced foreign policy advisor to the country's sheikhs. The Malaysian had begged a mutual friend to set up the meeting, and as they ate, Lo peppered Aloteba with questions. During the lunch, Aloteba noted that Lo was no mere student on a world tour. Instead, the young Malaysian was eager for specific information about power structures in the United Arab Emirates, which sheikhs held the ear of the crown prince, and who controlled the biggest pots of money. Lo sensed that Aloteba, an inner circle figure, could help guide him through the hallways of power in an up-and-coming nation. Situated on an island in the Persian Gulf, just off the Arabian Peninsula, Abu Dhabi wasn't yet an impressive sight to behold, with its 1970s-era buildings and generic glass office towers. But the emirate was in the midst of big changes. Oil prices were on an upward trajectory that would fill the coffers of Middle East governments, and Abu Dhabi's royal family was overhauling the city, the capital of the UAE. Not far from the seafood restaurant, the Emirates Palace, a $3 billion edifice slated to become one of the world's ritziest hotels, was under construction. With intelligent, piercing brown eyes and a closely shaved head that accentuated his angular features, Aloteba already had tasted more success by 30 than many men do in a lifetime. Yet his ambition for power and money was anything but sated. One of at least 12 children from different wives of Abu Dhabi's former oil minister, Aloteba had a privileged upbringing, attending the Cairo American College in Egypt, his mother's country, before studying at Georgetown, where he attended 4 years but did not graduate, and later at Washington's National Defense University. Eloquent and charming, he positioned himself back home as an interpreter of the West for the Emirates' royal family. At age 26, he became an advisor to Abu Dhabi's crown prince, Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, and he assumed the role of national security liaison with foreign governments. Aloteba was always dressed impeccably in a Western business suit, and he had a perfect American accent, so officials in Washington often forgot he was a foreigner, and the young Emirati became a trusted ally during the George W. Bush era. Over dinners, he expounded to journalists, diplomats, and White House officials about the need for the United States to take a hard line on Iran and Islamist militants, both of which he saw as an existential threat to Abu Dhabi's authoritarian government. By galvanizing support among Arab nations for the escalation of Bush's war in Iraq, Aloteba cemented his influence in Washington. A regular on nightly cable news programs, he exhibited poise and charm, which masked a stony self-belief and a tendency to curtness with those who reported to him. In an email exchange with Mohammed El Arian, then CEO of PIMCO, the giant U.S. investment firm, and one of the world's most recognizable Arab businessmen, Aloteba warned him, "As you get to know me, you will find out that I'm brutally honest and blunt." Aloteba was not as wealthy as many Emiratis. His father, also a businessman with interests in finance and real estate, had accrued a fortune. But as one among so many children, Aloteba did not have the wealth to keep up with the royals, with their mansions, yachts, and other luxuries. The Emirati led a second life that was costly to maintain, and he needed cash to compete with the princes of the Gulf. In conservative Abu Dhabi, Aloteba dressed in billowing robes and a gutra, the traditional Emirati headdress. But in the United States, like many senior Arab figures, once they escaped the strictures of life at home, he lived a decidedly more rakish lifestyle. Not yet married, he supplied a Florida modeling agency with lists of his preferred women, mainly brunettes. Professionally successful, he still had an interest in self-enrichment. While well-versed in Arab politics, Aloteba was a novice at business. To make money, he became involved with a construction company set up by a partner. The pair co-invested in projects in the Middle East, but Aloteba remained in the shadows. His main contribution to the business was to provide wasta, or connections, in Arabic. Here was just the kind of contact Lowe was seeking out. An influential figure, yet a striver. One who was still on the rise, knew nothing about business, and was amenable to a meeting with an unknown Malaysian. Over the lunch, Lowe held out the prospect of deals between the Middle East and Southeast Asia, especially Malaysia, which he talked up to Oteba as a growing economy. It was mainly bluster. Outside of throwing college parties, Lowe had no experience of brokering deals. And apart from his previous knack for borrowing money from family friends, no real special access in Malaysia. But Lowe did not let those facts stop him. As he listened to the persuasive Malaysian, Oteba was intrigued by his talk of potential business relationships, and he began to open doors for Lowe in Abu Dhabi. Soon after their first meeting, Oteba introduced the young Malaysian to Khaldun Khalifa Al Mubarak, another young, ambitious Emirati who ran an investment fund called Mubadala Development. With prominent, arching eyebrows and sleek, frameless glasses, Al Mubarak was a charming figure who spoke calmly and easily broke into a smile. The son of an Emirati ambassador murdered on the streets of Paris by a Palestinian terrorist group in 1984, Al Mubarak was, like Oteba, a trusted aide to Abu Dhabi's most powerful sheikh, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. At Wharton, Lowe could be indolent, scraping through with the bare minimum of effort. Yet here in Abu Dhabi, he was getting a genuine education in how the world worked. Abu Dhabi had formed Mubadala a year earlier, in 2002, to diversify its oil-dependent economy. The idea was to raise capital from international markets, plowing the money into industries like real estate and semiconductors. Lowe could see how Al Mubarak, only in his late 20s and a smooth talker, was in a position of considerable power, with control over big chunks of Abu Dhabi's economy. Mubadala was part of a trend in which rich states were playing a greater role in the global economy. Sovereign wealth funds had been around since the 1950s, when Saudi Arabia and Kuwait set up entities to find ways to invest their oil wealth with a long-term outlook. Other examples followed, from Norway's government pension fund to the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, the Emirates' main wealth fund. By Lowe's visit, sovereign wealth funds controlled $3.5 trillion in assets, larger than the annual GDP of most Western nations. But Mubadala was novel. Rather than simply invest oil profits, securing them for future generations, the fund was borrowing from global markets and actively trying to move the economy in new directions. What Lowe saw in Abu Dhabi planted a seed in his mind. Malaysia had a sovereign wealth fund, Khazana Nasional, but nothing like Mubadala. It would take 6 years for Lowe to establish himself as an Al Mubarak-like figure, controlling his own fund in Malaysia. In the near term, he had a more achievable goal: to turn his newfound Arab contacts into business opportunities. Whatever Al Mubarak made of this cocksure young Malaysian, it would not be long before they found common ground on which to operate. Back at Wharton for his final semester, Lowe set up his first company, the British Virgin Islands-based Winton Group. The name stood for Win Tons of Money, he told friends, who were unsure if it was a joke. Ivy League schools draw students from across the globe, whose families pay the huge fees in return for the networking opportunities and the brand name. In their senior years, the best students compete for jobs at Goldman Sachs or McKinsey & Company. Lowe's brother, Zen Lowe, who studied at Cambridge University in England, joined Goldman out of college. But Lowe had no time for the well-trodden path, figuring he could make more money without the constrictions of an office job, and he set about pitching Winton as a vehicle for Middle Eastern investors to get involved in projects in Malaysia. It started small, with some seed capital from the families of friends from Kuwait and other countries, and bought some stocks. But it wouldn't do any major deals until Lowe left Wharton for good. As his senior year ended in 2005, Lowe had a plan in mind: to return to Malaysia and look for ways to do business with his Wharton and Harrow contacts. A young financier with his own company, Lowe was ambitious. But he needed to find an influential backer at home. Fortunately, from his father's real estate investment in London, he had one. The powerful family of Najib Razak. Chapter 4. We're going to need a bigger van. Hong Kong, China, December 2007. In the lobby of Hong Kong's opulent Shangri-La Hotel, perched on a steep hill with views over the city's skyscrapers and the narrow harbor below, there was a commotion. The throng of handlers, security personnel, and assorted sycophants who clung around Malaysian Deputy Prime Minister Najib Razak and his wife Rosma Mansour were trying to load the car taking them to the airport. But there was a problem. And Rosma, her hair in a bouffant, the product of hours at the salon, and bedecked in expensive jewelry, was losing patience. Najib had spent the past couple of days meeting fund managers with Credit Suisse, the investment bank, aimed at drumming up foreign investment. Malaysia's commodities-heavy economy was beginning to attract the attention of Wall Street banks. While Najib sat in conference rooms, Rosma had indulged in Hong Kong's plethora of luxury boutiques. Now there was a problem. Rosma's towering pile of boxes and shopping bags would not fit into the car taking them to the Malaysian government jet that was on standby in the VIP hangar at Chek-Lapkok Airport. Scrambling, Rosma's staff eventually found a van to haul the excess baggage. It took so long to make the arrangements and load the cargo hold, the jet did not take off from Malaysia until after midnight. As the heir to a Malaysian political dynasty, his father and uncle had both been prime ministers. Najib and his wife were accustomed to a retinue of handlers who looked after their every need. In his mid-50s, with thick red lips and a salt-and-pepper mustache, his face often wearing a look of happy befuddlement, Najib was the epitome of an entitled politician. His father, Abdul Razak, tried to instill an old-fashioned morality into Najib and his four younger brothers. When the boys asked for a swimming pool at the prime minister's official residence, their father rejected the proposal, lecturing his children on how a public servant should not use state funds for personal pleasure. But Abdul Razak died young, when Najib was only 22, and with him any restraining influence also vanished. From then on, the boys, and especially Najib, were enveloped in the privileged bubble of the ruling United Malays National Organization, or UMNO. Educated at Malvern College, an illustrious British boarding school, and the University of Nottingham, Najib preferred English to Malay. Like an English gentleman, he had a penchant for expensive cigars and watched English TV shows like Yes Minister, a sitcom about a bumbling government minister. On the back of his revered father's name, he held a string of plum government positions. A deputy minister by his mid-20s, Najib didn't bother himself much with the mundane details of governance, preferring to attend events and make speeches. From the outset, he was surrounded by yes-men. UMNO had ruled Malaysia since its independence from Britain in 1957. Malaysia held regular elections, but the system was deeply flawed and corrupt. In the 1970s, Najib's father ushered in policies whose effect was to help Malays, the majority ethnic group. The government reserved university places for Malays, gave special financial handouts to Malays, and even favored Malay-owned companies for state contracts. By 2007, these policies had spawned a thick web of graft, in which businesses, many controlled by Chinese and Indian Malaysians, had to pay kickbacks to the likes of Najib and Rosma in order to operate. Rosma's origins were somewhat more humble. Her parents were middle-class schoolteachers, but she had partly grown up on the grounds of the palace of a Malaysian sultan, who had adopted the family as his own. The experience had exposed Rosma to wealth from a young age, but also instilled in her a sense of insecurity, of not truly belonging to the aristocratic world she inhabited, according to people who know her. Fascinated by royalty, Rosma reportedly eyed members of Brunei's royal family for marriage before she met Najib in the 1980s. She was working for a property company, and he was a chief minister. They married soon after, a second union for them both. When Rosma first boarded a government private jet, she was enthralled by her new surroundings. To compensate for her common origins, she began to dress in fine silks and precious jewels. She could be humorous, but she also exhibited a draconian streak, yelling at aides and cutting off contact with a daughter from her first marriage because she disliked her choice of husband. Relationships, for her, appeared to be transactional. Foreign businessmen seeking government support for a new venture would often meet her first, and she'd set up a follow-up encounter with Najib. Grandees from the ruling UMNO party grew concerned about the deputy prime minister and his wife. Most politicians had made money through kickbacks for government contracts and property deals, and Najib was no exception. But by the mid-2000s, Rosma's spending had reached new extremes, even for Malaysia. One story that made the rounds involved her breezing into a Hermes store and informing the clerks of the few items she did not want to buy before ordering one of everything else. To finance her penchant for luxury items, Rosma was pilfering the state coffers. One Malaysian businessman detailed how it worked. He would buy properties from state-owned companies before selling them at a markup to other state firms, sharing the profit with Rosma. She was already an unpopular figure in Malaysia, having developed a reputation as a social climber and modern-day Imelda Marcos, whose penchant for high-end accessories like Birkin handbags by Hermes, which cost tens of thousands of dollars apiece, seemed beyond the reach of Najib's official salary. In late 2006, a Mongolian model, a girlfriend of a Najib aide, was shot dead, and her corpse was then blown up with C4 explosives. At the time she was killed, the dead woman's boyfriend, an aide in Najib's defense ministry, was facing accusations of accepting bribes worth more than $100 million from a French submarine company. A Malaysian court later convicted two police officers for the murder. At the time, the officers were part of Najib's personal security detail. Najib denied any knowledge of the killing, but the sordid affair stuck to him like a rotting smell. By 2007, with Najib harboring ambitions for the nation's top office, one once held by his father, the ambitious couple needed some good news. It arrived in the form of a friend of Rosma's son, a young man called Joe Low, whom they had met in London. On his return to Malaysia, after graduating from Wharton in the spring of 2005, Low set up offices on the 70th floor of the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur for his company, Winton. The pair of futuristic skyscrapers, the tallest buildings in the world in the late 1990s and early 2000s, were the premier address in Malaysia's capital, a symbol of the country's emergence from agrarian poverty within a generation. Encased in shiny chrome steel cladding, with a sky bridge linking the 41st floors, the towers featured in the 1999 film Entrapment with Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones. In the lobby, iron bars inserted into the black marble floor traced a swirling Islamic-inspired geometric pattern. Only the best-known Malaysian firms could afford an office in the towers. Chief among them was Petronas, the state oil company, whose profits had fueled Malaysia's economic transformation. Joe Low, his college graduation barely behind him, couldn't really afford such a prestigious address, but managed to arrange a loan from a local bank. Using the bank's money, he decorated the office, sparing no expense. The space featured an island boardroom in the center of the floor, with glass that frosted over at the touch of a button. A whiteboard inside printed out whatever was written on it. In the restrooms, the toilet seats adjusted automatically to the height of the occupant. There was even a wading pool for tired feet. For Malaysia at the time, this was more than cutting-edge technology. It was the most luxurious office space in the country. Low splashed money on staff, even though he had few investment deals in the pipeline. One of his first hires was Seatley Lin, the Singaporean whom he had befriended at Wharton. Seat had a sound understanding of finance, having gone to work for Singapore's central bank after college, before Low convinced him to join Winton. Extremely young-looking, with a cheerful smile, Seat acted as Low's details guy. Often, Low would begin a negotiation before asking Seat to take care of the details. Like his boss, Seat was impatient to get ahead. The key to his success at Wharton, he once boasted, was turning in essays that were big on buzzwords and short on substance. Eric Tan, a Malaysian whom Low referred to as Fat Eric, also became a key member of Low's entourage. A Malaysian who spoke heavily accented English, Tan would become Low's de facto body man, a partner so trusting of Low that he would sign any document without question. Low had met Tan in the nightclub world in Malaysia, and they would travel everywhere together, for work and vacations. Now, all Low needed was business. While at Wharton, he'd made contacts in the Middle East. Now, he wanted to bring rich Arabs to invest in Malaysia, perhaps making a fee for brokering a deal. To build allegiances, Low sent chocolates and flowers to prospective partners, and offered personal favors, securing appointments with sought-after doctors. But as a Chinese Malaysian, Low knew he needed a Malay protector if he were to really succeed in business. He had one in mind, the family of Najib Razak, whose stepson, Riza Aziz, he had gotten to know in London. The deputy prime minister himself was still out of reach, but a mutual friend introduced him to Nizam Razak, one of the politician's four brothers, and Low offered him space for free in Winton's office. Low enticed Nizam to co-invest in a high-end condominium project near the Petronas Towers that some contacts from Penang were developing. The problem with the co-investment was that Low didn't have any money. In fact, he had sizable debts from his bank loans. When it came time for the down payment, a businessman fixer of the Najib family came in to arrange financing and bail Low and Nizam out of the situation. Low was at a low ebb. After failing to pay the rent on the Petronas Towers office for several months, he had to give it up. Rather than getting him close to Najib's family, his efforts appeared to be in vain. They had disdain for him, one close aide of Najib said of Low. But Low was tenacious and resourceful, using every failure as an opportunity. He had gotten to know executives from the Kuwait Finance House, an Islamic bank, which had come in on the condominium property deal. In 2007, he tried to broker a deal for the Kuwait Finance House to take over a Malaysian bank. He failed again, but had added to his contact book. Low was becoming adept at obtaining meetings with powerful figures, putting himself in the room even though he had no track record. Later that year, he heard Khazanah, Malaysia's powerful sovereign wealth fund, was looking for partners to develop a gigantic construction project in the southern state of Johor, near the border with Singapore, to be known as the Iskandar Development Region. The project was an ambitious effort to create a financial and lifestyle center to rival wealthier Singapore, Southeast Asia's financial and commercial hub. Here was Low's chance. In Abu Dhabi, Low had observed firsthand the huge amounts of money that sovereign wealth funds control, and he saw an opportunity to broker a deal. Since Low's Middle East tour, Khaldun al-Mubarak, the chief executive of Mubadala, had grown in prestige. Buoyed by sky-high oil prices, Mubadala had taken sizable minority stakes in firms like Ferrari and Advanced Micro Devices, and al-Mubarak controlled a multi-billion dollar empire. Low's main contact in Abu Dhabi remained Youssef al-Oteiba, the political advisor to the Emirates' crown prince. On June 17, 2007, Low wrote an email to Oteiba with details of the plans for the Iskandar development, and suggested Mubadala could invest. He then arranged for Khazanah executives to fly to Abu Dhabi, where he set up meetings with Oteiba and others. Oteiba's name card is the only one you need in Abu Dhabi, Low joked as he introduced the Emirati to Khazanah executives. Low was punctilious, stage managing meetings and phone calls between Mubadala and Khazana, and sending around emails ahead of time with subject lines like sequence of events. He also acted as if the deal would go off the table if both sides didn't pounce now. Situating himself at the nexus of the deal-making, Lowe's behavior served to deepen the impression that he could deliver powerful Middle Eastern contacts. Lowe's ability to bring Mubadala to the table marked a revival after the mess of the failed condominium deal. He latched on to the opportunity it presented to build his political contacts in Malaysia. He already knew Deputy Prime Minister Najib's brother and his stepson, and he set about getting close to Najib and Rosma themselves. In 2007, Lowe formed an offshore company for Rosma and Najib to help pay for their daughter's expenses while studying at Georgetown. The Iskandar Land Project, with a big investment from the Middle East, offered Lowe a chance to show his worth. The young Malaysian told the politician about the deal and offered for Najib to take credit for it, all without having to do the legwork. The Iskandar project, right on Singapore's doorstep, would burnish Najib's credentials as a doer, a politician who could attract investment and finally propel Malaysia into the ranks of developed nations. As Rosma Mansour took the microphone, she beamed at the crowd. Clad in colorful traditional Malay silks, the wife of the deputy prime minister was enjoying playing host. The guests, soft drinks in hand, milled around the huge stateroom of Rosma and Najib's official residence, an impersonal, cavernous building with a pointed red-tiled roof and floor-to-ceiling windows that offered a sweeping view of gardens bordered by a man-made lake. Outside, a tropical downpour threatened to break out. At the back of the room, scurrying around, making sure everyone was having a good time and meeting the right people, was Joe Lowe. That night, in late August 2007, marked a new turn for Najib and Rosma, and they had the young Malaysian to thank for it. The guests had assembled at Najib's residence in the new city of Putrajaya, just outside Kuala Lumpur. Malaysia had moved the government there in the 1990s, hoping to develop a global technology hub. An impressive site of modern skyscrapers and Islamic-inspired domed edifices set around a huge lake, Putrajaya had never attracted sufficient capital or companies and felt somewhat forlorn, its multi-lane highways largely empty. Inside the residence, however, the mood was celebratory. The party was to mark the deal for Mubadala and the Kuwait Finance House to take a stake in the Iskandar Land Project. "I'd like to thank Joe Lowe for bringing Middle Eastern investment to Malaysia," Rosma told the room. Then, accompanied by a live band, she began to sing a number of ballads, as the bemused delegation from Abu Dhabi looked on. Afterwards, guests waited in line as Najib introduced Mubadala's chief executive around the room. Wearing a headdress and with a confident yet polite demeanor, Al-Mubarak had added another investment to his growing empire. All thanks to Lowe. The next morning, Mubadala signed a contract to invest $500 million in the Johor project of five-star hotels, residences, and a golf village. For Lowe, the deal was a seminal moment. His ability to source Middle Eastern money put him in good stead with Najib and Rosma, reinforcing his claims to hold sway in the Arab world. The couple was fascinated by the Gulf, where rulers enjoyed lives of exceptional luxury. In parallel, Lowe was making other efforts to ensure he became enmeshed with the family. A few weeks earlier, he had flown to London for the high school graduation party of Nuryana Najib, Najib and Rosma's daughter, who was leaving the exclusive Seven Oaks School to study at Georgetown in the United States. But there was a problem. Lowe had expected to make serious money for himself from the deal, and he was incensed when Khazana turned down his request to be paid a broker fee. Run by professionals, the fund was too clean for Lowe's purposes. Going forward, he really needed to control his own pot of investment money. To do so, Lowe prepared to dive deeply into the world of offshore finance. Chapter 5. A Nice Toy. Washington, D.C., August 2008. In the fall of 2008, Oteiba's business partner, a Jordanian named Shaher Awartani, wrote him an email containing some very welcome news. The pair was about to make around $10 million through a deal that Lowe had set up in Malaysia. Perhaps worried about too many direct interactions with this Malaysian broker, Oteiba relied on Awartani to communicate with Lowe. Yet the Malaysian was starting to prove a very lucrative connection. "Great news. It's nice to see our efforts finally paying off," Oteiba wrote back. Soon after, Awartani suggested buying a Ferrari after what Oteiba described as a transfer from Joe. "I think we each deserve to buy a nice toy in celebration. What do you think? The 458 Italia, maybe?" Awartani wrote in an email to Oteiba. The ambassador responded that such ostentatious consumption in Abu Dhabi will just attract unnecessary attention. Oteiba had reasons to keep his dealings with Lowe under wraps. A few months earlier, he had become the UAE's ambassador to the United States, fast establishing himself as one of Washington's most prominent diplomats. His dinner parties at the ambassador's palatial residence on the Virginia bank of the Potomac River, catered by celebrity chefs such as Wolfgang Puck, attracted White House staffers, members of Congress, and top cable news hosts. Sometimes the ambassador invited guests down to his man cave, a basement area with a huge flat-screen television, to watch basketball. Accompanied by his glamorous wife, Abir, an Egyptian-born civil engineer, Oteiba seemed to attend every social event in the capital. With his Western ways and Abu Dhabi's support of the fight against militant Islam, the ambassador was a popular figure, whether at cocktail parties or propounding his views on Morning Joe. But Oteiba, only in his mid-30s, had a hidden side. A business life, one which he kept away from the limelight. The ambassador had been right to bet on Joe Lowe. His association with the Malaysian looked like it would make him exceptionally rich. Denied a broker fee in the Iskandar land deal, Lowe had cast around for another way to profit. He had started out trying to be a classic dealmaker, angling to earn a fee for bringing Mubadala into the investment. But he had been blocked. To get the payoff he believed he deserved, and to repay Ambassador Oteiba, Lowe would do whatever it took. He came up with a convoluted yet brilliant scheme. Malaysia was abuzz over Mubadala's plans for the giant Iskandar project. With blueprints calling for new roads, homes, malls, and industrial developments, builders would be jockeying to win lucrative contracts. At this time, Lowe heard about two Malaysian construction companies that were for sale. Perhaps he could buy them cheaply and win contracts on the Iskandar development. To finance the multi-million dollar purchase price, Lowe needed more loans. But he was still a nobody in the eyes of banks, a low-level businessman with a poor track record. To burnish his image and get his hands on the bank's money, he once again turned to powerful friends. As a vehicle to make the purchase, Lowe set up a British Virgin Islands entity called the Abu Dhabi Kuwait Malaysia Investment Company, and gave free shares to Ambassador Oteiba and minor aristocrats from Kuwait and Malaysia. He was creating the impression that prominent individuals were behind the company. With such illustrious backing now in place, Lowe had no trouble persuading Malaysian banks to lend tens of millions of dollars. He used some of the debt to fund the investment group's acquisition of the construction companies. At the same time, a subsidiary of Winton, Lowe's company, took out further loans to finance the purchase of a minority stake in the Iskandar land project, alongside Mubadala. Instead of receiving a broker fee, Lowe became a co-investor. He then set about creating a fiction that major Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds also were involved in the purchase of the construction companies. If Lowe could make it appear as if his personal ventures were backed by powerful Middle Eastern funds, he could attract even more money. To create the illusion, he turned to the opaque world of offshore finance. Lowe knew about offshore financial centers from his father, Larry, who had a myriad of overseas accounts. It was normal for rich Asians, fearing instability at home, or just to evade taxes, to set up offshore accounts in secretive jurisdictions like the British Virgin Islands and the Cayman Islands. The offshore designation typically refers to jurisdictions whose financial systems are much larger than their domestic economies. In other words, the banking system exists purely for non-residents to stash cash, unlike international financial centers in London and New York that also service local citizens and companies. In recent years, offshore centers have come under pressure to share information on their clients. But many of these centers, reliant on annual fees from the thousands of companies seeking a cloak of secrecy, remain safe harbors for money launderers and other criminals to wash cash and avoid taxes. One recent estimate puts the money stashed in offshore financial centers since 1970 at $32 trillion, a figure equal to the combined economies of the United States and China, with hundreds of billions lost in tax revenues. The now 26-year-old Lo was already mastering this hidden realm of the global economy. He would have known that the Cayman Islands, home to branches of U.S. banks and hedge funds, had improved its information sharing with Washington. The British Virgin Islands in the Caribbean, however, had a no-questions-asked approach to company incorporation, and was where he had set up Winton. In 2007, his sister, Lo Mei Lin, became a solicitor of the Supreme Court of the British Virgin Islands. And tiny Seychelles, in the Indian Ocean, had the advantage of not seeming to care who owned its shell companies. Most importantly, Lo had experienced the ease of setting up an offshore account. Almost anyone could do it. For only a few $1,000s, a corporate services firm like U.S.-headquartered Trident Trust or Mossack Fonseca of Panama would open an account or form a company and deal with all the paperwork. The Panama Papers, a leak in 2016 of hundreds of thousands of Mossack Fonseca client records going back to the 1970s, showed the extent of the use of offshore accounts by the global elite, from the family of Chinese President Xi Jinping to actress Emma Watson. Without this secrecy, the scam that was about to unfold would have been impossible. For the next step of his scheme, Lo set up two shell companies in the Seychelles. The firms, ADIA Investment Corporation and KIA Investment Corporation, appeared, given their names, to be related to the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, or ADIA, and Kuwait Investment Authority, or KIA, two of the most famous multi-billion-dollar sovereign wealth funds in the world. But the lookalike companies were purely Lo's creation, with no links to Abu Dhabi or Kuwait. In setting up ADIA Investment Corporation, Lo experimented with another financial trick that he would add to his repertoire. The company issued just one unregistered share, valued at $1, and it was controlled by whoever physically held the stock certificate. These bearer shares were banned in many jurisdictions, including Great Britain and the United States. Nevada and Wyoming in 2007 became the last states to abolish their use, because they allowed owners of companies to hide behind layers of secrecy and made it nearly impossible for regulators to determine the owner of an asset at a given point in time. Seeking to find tax cheats in the early 2000s, the United States started to pressure offshore centers to hand over details of the beneficial owners of companies and accounts. Even the British Virgin Islands had recently outlawed the practice of bearer shares. But in the Seychelles, Lo learned, they were still permitted. Next, Lo had these look-alike offshore companies take minority stakes in the Malaysian construction firms. It now would appear to any prospective business partner doing due diligence that royals from Kuwait and Malaysia, as well as Ambassador Oteba and two major sovereign wealth funds, were Lo's partners in plans to develop the Iskandar project. With this elaborate structure in place, Lo went fishing. He needed a mark, a rich but financially naive businessman who would buy the companies and land from his supposedly illustrious investment group for a high price. He found one in Tabe Mahmood, the 71-year-old chief minister of Sarawak, a remote, jungle-covered Malaysian state on Borneo Island. separated from the rest of the country by hundreds of miles of sea. Short and elfish, with silver-gray hair, Tabe was one of Malaysia's richest individuals, the product of decades in businesses such as logging and palm oil plantations that had led to the deforestation of his state. A wily and long-serving politician, Tabe dressed in white suits, drove a white Rolls Royce, and owned a white grand piano, which had once belonged to Liberace. He was not, however, a skilled financier. The chief minister had come to hear of Low, who was touting Mubadala's ambitions to invest more widely in Malaysia after the Iskandar deal. Tabe was keen for investment to build palm oil refineries and other energy projects in Sarawak. Low held out the possibility of huge Middle Eastern outlays. But in the meantime, Low persuaded Tabe to buy the construction companies and the Iskandar land. A few months later, Winton, Low's company, completed the sale of its stake in the Iskandar land to UBG, a holding company controlled by Chief Minister Tabe, in return for cash and shares. The deal made Low the largest shareholder of UBG. He crowed to friends that the sale had netted a $110 million profit for Winton by selling to Tabe at a significant markup. The Malaysian had made his first killing, and he traded in his E-Series Mercedes for a black-colored Ferrari, taking his new toy for nighttime joyrides around Kuala Lumpur. But there were problems on the horizon. Low's haul was staggering, and Tabe, who still held a stake in UBG, would be furious when he found out the premium he had paid. Oteba, too, started to hear talk of these huge profits that Low had reaped and worried that he was only being fed scraps. It was Oteba, after all, who had lent his name to this deal, embellishing the fiction that Abu Dhabi officially was involved. "Our friend Joe may be shafting us on the Iskandar Development Region issue," Arwatani wrote to Oteba. "My opinion is we may be getting just a bone to keep us happy and quiet." On U.S. nightly cable news, Oteba had a charming demeanor as he explained Middle East affairs to American audiences. But, used to wielding power, he could be stony in private, and Low's perceived double-dealing infuriated him. He viewed Low as a useful contact, one who offered access to potentially lucrative deals in Malaysia, but it was the Malaysian who ultimately needed him, and his high-level contacts in Abu Dhabi, far more than he relied on Low. "He needs to understand very clearly that he can't do much without us knowing," Oteba replied to Awartani, urging him to confront Low. "Personally, I prefer the direct approach because it will scare him a bit." Even his partners were starting to distrust Low. But at that moment, he had finally hit a gusher of cash, all without holding down a regular job. He was 27 years old, only 3 years out of college. While most of his Wharton classmates were grappling with the turmoil engulfing Wall Street and the world financial system in late 2008, Low was already sitting on a fortune that most of his finance industry classmates from Wharton could only dream of. Without producing anything, Low had shown an unusual ability to navigate the chambers of power and persuade investors by holding out the promise of large returns. He had made money for Oteba and his other influential sponsors, strengthening his web of contacts. Not all the cash was really his. He'd have to figure out a way to get some money back to Tabe. But Low was starting to develop a deal-making reputation. He was no longer a nobody, but an investor with a track record who was now a fixture at events, business meetings, but also society gatherings held by Kuala Lumpur's elite. It was this precocious renown that landed him on the radar screen of an ambitious banker at Wall Street's most powerful financial institution. Chapter 6. Dr. Leisner, I presume. The Great Wall of China, June 2006. Waiters bustled around Chinese banquet tables, which had been set up under a tent at the Great Wall near Beijing for a celebration with a very special guest of honor. Moments later, Lloyd Blankfein, the aggressive former trader who recently had been named chief executive of Goldman Sachs Group, arrived with an entourage of senior American and Chinese bankers, Blankfein was the new king of Wall Street, and Goldman was holding a symbolic global board meeting on the Great Wall, a sign of the importance of China, and Asia more broadly, for the powerful bank. Hank Paulson, who had just left the chief executive role, had steered Goldman deep into China, where it made money advising the communist government on how to privatize companies, and became one of the first foreign banks to set up a local securities joint venture. Paulson had quit weeks earlier to become President George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary, and Blankfein was keen to keep the focus turned on Asia. The region remained somewhat of a backwater. Wall Street banks still earned well over half of their profit in the United States, raising capital for clients, advising on mergers and acquisitions, and selling profitable derivative products, not to mention making hefty bets with their own money, including on the teetering housing market. Ahead of the financial crisis, Asia accounted for only around a tenth of Wall Street's profits, of which China was a major driver. By 2006, however, the winds were shifting. The board meeting on the Great Wall was largely a symbolic affair, but as the attendees looked out from their perch down over the plains toward Beijing, the talk was tinged with optimism about the future of Asia. There was growing interest in the region, as China's economy, churning out toys, clothes, machine parts, and other manufactured goods for the United States and Europe, grew at double-digit rates. Southeast Asian neighbors like Malaysia, which supplied China with raw materials, were registering their own solid economic expansions of more than 5% annually. Goldman's honchos began telling staff they had better chances of promotion if they moved to Asia. A sweetener to get employees to uproot their families from New York and London and relocate to Hong Kong or Singapore. In early 2009, Tim Leissner, a rising star at Goldman in Asia, stepped out of a car at the Istana Negara in Kuala Lumpur. With mustard-colored domes, the imposing hillside official residence of Malaysia's king evoked an Indian Maharaja's palace. It was an incongruous location for Leissner, a 39-year-old German, to be holding a meeting. 6'3" tall and dashing, Leissner, head of investment banking in Southeast Asia, had spent a decade generating new business for Goldman throughout the region. Today's meeting was different. After flying in from his base in Hong Kong, Leissner went to purchase a songkok, a traditional Malay hat, a piece of headgear that was de rigueur when meeting Malaysia's king. He was there to talk with the Sultan of Terengganu, Mizan Zainal Abidin, one of the country's 9 hereditary princes, who at the time was also king of Malaysia under a system that rotates the crown among the sultans. Mizan often received guests in ceremonial Malay attire, a headdress made from folded embroidered silk, a short golden threaded sarong over black pants, with a kris dagger tucked into a waistband. But for this meeting, he was dressed in a Western business suit. Typically, Leissner would scout for deals in Malaysia by maintaining close ties with chief executives and politicians. The country's economy was a minnow compared to China, where Goldman was focusing most of its attention in Asia. But Leissner had spent almost a decade building connections in Malaysia, and Goldman had started to make respectable money advising on deals. Sometimes he would rely on middlemen, politically connected Malaysian brokers who took a fee for making introductions, a normal practice in Asia. This meeting had been organized by Joe Low, who was only 27 years old, but seemed extremely well-connected. Leissner had met Low through a local banker at Goldman, and the young Malaysian registered an unfavorable first impression. Low seemed like a striver, someone who tried to set up deals and take a cut without doing the legwork or risking any money of his own. Leissner told friends that he considered Low a dodgy character. Still, Low had investment ideas, and the Goldman banker was ambitious and hungry for the next big thing. Low had told Leissner about the Sultan's plans to set up an investment fund to manage his state's oil and gas wealth. The Sultan, Low had said, wanted to hire Goldman. A good talker, Leissner knew how to charm the Asian dignitaries, and he hit it off with the Sultan. By the end of the meeting, Goldman had clinched a contract to advise on the formation of the new fund, which was to be known as the Terengganu Investment Authority. Goldman's fee for setting up the authority was a paltry $300,000, a sum barely worth getting out of bed for by Wall Street standards. But Leisner knew how to play the long game. The Terengganu deal was the beginning of a line of business that in short order would earn hundreds of millions of dollars for Goldman. Suddenly, the one-time backwater of Malaysia would become one of Goldman's biggest profit centers anywhere in the world. Growing up in the northern German town of Wolfsburg, close to Hanover, Leisner led a privileged childhood as the middle of three brothers. His father was a senior executive with Volkswagen, which is based in the town, and he attended a local high school, playing tennis most afternoons at a private club from the age of 10. In the summers, the family would send him to exclusive training camps in Europe and the United States, where he hit with star players such as Steffi Graf. When he was 17, Leisner spent a year as an exchange student at the private Millbrook School in upstate New York. His host family considered him reserved, a trait they took to be typically German, but he quickly dove into his new American life. He played basketball and wide receiver for the football team. The local newspaper described his slew of life's gifts that included confidence, intelligence, looks, affluence, and athletic talent. The sports coach praised him as the most coachable student he had ever taught and a great role player. He attracted women easily, almost without trying, and had a tennis-playing American girlfriend. The trip gave Leisner a taste for life abroad. After college in Germany, he headed to the States, to the University of Hartford in Connecticut, for an MBA. The class was filled with international students, and he met a French woman of Iranian descent. They moved to London and married, and Leisner joined J.P. Morgan as an associate, the lowest level of banker. He was hungry for success, and despite his gifts, there were signs of a willingness to cut corners. In 1993, while employed at J.P. Morgan, Leisner acquired a doctorate in business administration from the University of Somerset. The college, which closed down a few years later, was known for selling degrees for a few thousand dollars, especially to Americans looking to burnish their credentials with a certificate from a serious-sounding British institution. Leisner began using the title Doctor at speaking engagements, and soon after, he secured a promotion to vice president at J.P. Morgan. While in London, he was involved in a deal to finance a power plant in Indonesia, and the work got him interested in Asia. His marriage was falling apart, and by 1997, he moved to Hong Kong, where he had secured a job with Lehman Brothers. In the 1990s, Hong Kong was a city in flux. The territory of 7 million, situated on mountainous islands and part of the Chinese mainland, had become a playground for expatriate financiers. Asian economies like Thailand and South Korea had been through a decade of heady growth, and bankers worked long hours, partied in the bars and fleshpots of Wan Chai, the city's entertainment district, and took jaunts to Hong Kong's outer islands in private yachts on the weekends. By 1997, however, the party atmosphere was souring. After 156 years of colonial rule, Britain was handing Hong Kong back to China. The Asian financial crisis was in full swing, the result of years of reckless borrowing to finance investments in property and other risky sectors. It was a typical financial bubble, and when speculators like George Soros attacked the region's overvalued currencies, angering Malaysia's then Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, foreign banks were forced to book losses on loans that went bad. For a financier like Leisner, there was an upside to all that volatility. Among foreign bankers, Asia had developed a reputation as a place to turbocharge a Wall Street career. Competition out in Hong Kong and Singapore was less fierce, and bankers were given more latitude to make big financial trades. In 1995, a rogue trader at Britain's Barings Bank named Nick Leeson made unauthorized bets on Japanese stocks that led to the bank's collapse. But as Leisner was arriving, activity in capital markets, the raising of money through selling stocks and bonds, was drying up thanks to the crisis. Lehman wasn't too exposed, though, and it began to advise the region's cash-strapped governments on a wave of privatizations to raise money. Hong Kong-based bankers often kept a blistering pace, traveling non-stop around the region, and Leisner was no exception. On one deal, he worked alongside Goldman bankers to help a state-owned Thai petroleum company sell a chunk of shares. The bankers worked 18-hour days, finishing at 2 a.m. and partying in Bangkok's notorious bars for a couple more hours before starting over. The crisis forged close links between the Wall Street bankers who had chosen the less crowded field of Asia to further their careers. Leisner's work ethic impressed Goldman, considered top of the pile of global banks, and he was offered a job. He accepted. Shortly after Leisner joined, Goldman moved its Asian headquarters into gleaming new offices in Hong Kong's Cheung Kong Center, a 70-floor skyscraper with breathtaking views of the Peak, a mountain that towers over the Central Financial District, and Victoria Harbor, a busy sea channel separating Hong Kong Island from the mainland. One floor had meeting rooms adorned with multi-million dollar Chinese art, including ancient calligraphy and ink drawings of mist-shrouded mountains. An antique terracotta horse, donated by Li Ka-shing, the Hong Kong billionaire who owned the building, stood inside the reception area. At Goldman, Leisner met and fell in love with Judy Chan, a junior analyst at the bank, and they married after the German banker's divorce from his first wife. Chan was from an Indonesian-Chinese family that had made a fortune in coal mining, and the first of many connected women that Leisner would court. The wedding ceremony at a luxury Hong Kong hotel featured suckling pigs with flashing lights in their eye sockets. The couple had two daughters together, but he was rarely at home. As an executive director in the mergers and acquisitions division, Leisner practically lived on planes, incessantly looking for deals on which Goldman could advise or offer financing. After a few lean years, as Asia picked itself up from the crisis, Leisner began to strike gold. In 2002, Goldman sold shares for a Malaysian cell phone company owned by Ananda Krishnan, a billionaire whom Leisner had gotten to know. The $800 million IPO was the largest offering in Asia that year, and Leisner was promoted to managing director. The following year, he helped bring in another Krishnan-related deal, this time selling IPO shares for a satellite television company called Astro. Then, in May 2006, Leisner beat out other banks to snag a role advising on Malaysia's largest ever corporate takeover, a $2 billion deal for a local power company. Goldman's fee on the deal, $9 million, was respectable, even by U.S. norms, and much fatter than run-of-the-mill Malaysian payouts. Goldman's colleagues noticed how Leisner had an uncanny ability to make clients feel like they had a deep, personal connection with him. He was a relationship banker, skilled at reeling in important executives through a kind of personal magnetism rather than a structuring guy, one of the mathematical whizzes who priced and sold complex derivative products. Since coming to Asia, Leisner had deepened his connections, especially in Malaysia. He was funny and animated, speaking in German-accented English, and a consummate networker who told people what they wanted to hear. He would sit next to clients in the boardroom rather than across the table. At one society wedding in Kuala Lumpur, he spent the entire dinner out of his seat, making the rounds of the hotel ballroom. "He loved clients and he loved deals," said Joe Stevens, a senior banker who worked with him at Goldman. As Goldman Sachs ramped up its Asia business under Hank Paulson and now Lloyd Blankfein, Tim Leisner was a beneficiary. In October 2006, he made partner, one of 115 staff that year to be invited into Goldman's inner sanctum. The bank kept the partner pool to only a few hundred people, or no more than 2% of its 30,000 full-time employees. And those anointed were personally called by Blankfein. The honor came with a pay bump to a base salary of almost $1 million, and access to larger bonuses and proprietary investments, deals that Goldman's top bankers reserved for themselves. Leisner had begun to make real money for Goldman in Malaysia, and he was reaping the benefits of the bank's Asia focus. Of those who made partner in 2006, more than a fifth were from the region, out of whack with the fees generated there. It was a signal from Blankfein that Goldman saw a bright future. But there were whispers